Democratic Party leaders have got to start getting around the country, not just to raise money in affluent blue state communities, but to talk to low-income and working-class people in poor counties in red states. If I ran for president, I was determined to visit areas that Democrats often ignore and spread the progressive message. To the degree possible, our campaign would be a 50-state effort. Our goal would be not just winning over Democratic voters and visiting Democratic strongholds. It would be to appeal to those who had given up on the political process, those who had not yet become involved, and those who were unfamiliar with the progressive ideology. This would be a very different type of campaign. As part of that goal, on my very first exploratory swing, Phil and I headed south to some of the most conservative areas in the country. In mid-October 2013, Vermont's Democratic Socialist Senator, one of the most progressive members of Congress, was heading to Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, and South Carolina. I wanted to get a sense of what was going on there. What could we learn? It has always been my view that healthcare must be a right of all people. In Mississippi, I learned why that must happen as soon as possible. In my position as a member of the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, I met with a group of African-American healthcare workers in the Jackson Hines Comprehensive Health Center in Jackson, Mississippi. They described the dismal healthcare conditions for poor people in that state and how there were entire counties that had no doctors. Think about it. In the United States of America, entire counties that have no doctors. In Mississippi, it also turned out that many people, despite being poor, were ineligible for Medicaid because of stringent and unfair state requirements. My Republican colleagues in Congress tell me over and over again that we have the greatest healthcare system in the world. Really? In Mississippi and in many other areas of the country, there are counties in low-income areas where thousands of people have no health insurance at all. And for those who do, there is no access to medical care at all. That system doesn't sound so great to me. As chairman of the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs, I also had the opportunity to visit the VA hospital in Jackson. The following year, in August 2014, I returned to Mississippi. On that trip, we had an unforgettable meeting in Jackson at the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, the IBEW, Local 480 Union Hall. I was excited by the idea of meeting with trade unionists in Mississippi, but had my doubts as to how many people would actually show up to meet with the socialist senator from Vermont. We were very pleasantly surprised. The doors opened and people kept coming. We ended up filling the hall with several hundred attendees, almost all working-class people. Approximately two-thirds were white, one-third were black. There were also a number of black members from the state legislature at the meeting, as well as the chairman of the state Democratic Party. People were happy to attend because it was very unusual for a non-Republican U.S. senator to visit Mississippi. After all, the state was deep red. There was no money to raise. Why would a Democratic senator visit? I was introduced by the local union president, John Smith. He and his wife could not have been more gracious, and I still have the denim IBEW jacket made in America they gave me. I spoke for a while and then asked a question to the audience that had been on my mind for a long time. This is what I asked. How does it happen that in one of the poorest states in this country, Mississippi, voters keep electing right-wing Republicans who have contempt for working people and who push policies that benefit the rich at the expense of nearly everyone else? And the answer that I got back was race, race, race. The white population in Mississippi was overwhelmingly Republican. In 2012, Obama received, unbelievably, only 10% of the white vote. For 2 hours, that was the issue we discussed. How do we get white working-class Americans to stop voting against their own best interests? What kind of efforts do we have to make to bring people together, black and white, around economic issues? Republicans have cultivated into a fine art the ability to divide people up by race, gender, nationality, or sexual orientation. That's what they do. That is the essence of their politics. They get one group to fight against another group while their wealthy friends and campaign contributors get richer and laugh all the way to the bank. At a time when so many Americans in Mississippi and around the country are hurting financially, how do we overcome those divisions and bring people together? This is not just a challenge in places like the South. It is a challenge that progressives face throughout the country. We lose when we are divided. We win when we are united. At that meeting, I heard from white workers on that subject. I heard from black workers and black members of the state legislature. The meeting was intense. I came away with an extraordinary amount of respect for the white workers there who were prepared to stand up for justice and solidarity, not racism. I had equal respect for the black workers who, after years of political and economic discrimination, kept their heads high and continued the struggle. In the environment in which they all lived, none of this was easy. The small town of Philadelphia, Mississippi, has a unique place in American history. In June 1964, in the midst of the civil rights struggle over desegregation and voting rights, three civil rights workers, James Chaney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner, were brutally murdered there by members of the Ku Klux Klan. The killings outraged the nation. Then in 1980, just coincidentally, no doubt, Ronald Reagan selected Philadelphia, Mississippi, as his first campaign stop after winning the Republican nomination. On August 3, 1980, Reagan stated in Philadelphia, quote, "I believe in states' rights. I believe we have distorted the balance of our government today by giving powers that were never intended to be given in the Constitution to that federal establishment," end of quote. He went on to promise to, quote, "restore to states and local governments the power that properly belongs to them," end of quote. In other words, racism and discrimination would be protected in the South if Reagan was elected. That was the Republicans' Southern strategy, and it worked. What was going on in Philadelphia, Mississippi now, 50 years after the murders and 34 years after the Reagan visit? I was interested in finding out. In Vermont, I do a lot of town meetings in high schools. I love speaking to young people. Why not do something similar in Philadelphia, Mississippi? My office contacted the principal of the local high school, Jason Gentry, and he was kind enough to allow us to hold a town meeting in the school. I was escorted into the school auditorium by the black chief of police and spoke to an integrated student body. I was probably the first U.S. senator most of the students had ever seen. The meeting went well, with a good question and answer period. Most strikingly, after the meeting, a number of the faculty stayed around for an informal discussion. What I learned was that many of the students came from very poor families. Most of them worked long hours after school to help provide for their families, and hunger was a serious issue. Some families just did not have enough food. During that first trip through the South, I had the opportunity to give a keynote address to the South Carolina Progressive Network. The turnout was high, followed by a good discussion. The event was held at the historic and beautiful Penn Center in Beaufort, South Carolina, founded in 1862, and one of the first schools in the South for freed slaves. It was also the location where Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. held retreats for his organization, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Penn Center remains an important part of African-American culture in the community there. In Vermont, California, Massachusetts, and many other states, it is no big deal to be a progressive. You believe in social, racial, and economic justice. You want to combat climate change, you support gay marriage, and that's what most of your friends, neighbors, and co-workers also believe. You're part of the crowd. In South Carolina and other conservative states, it is very different. In South Carolina, there are two Republican senators, a Republican governor, and a very Republican state legislature. In fact, in 2014, because of a resignation, two U.S. Senate seats in the state were up for election. Unbelievably, the Democrats were unable to put up one serious candidate. To be a progressive in South Carolina and other conservative states means to be in the minority, sometimes a weak minority. It takes a lot of courage to maintain progressive views in that kind of political climate, and I applaud those who do. At the South Carolina Progressive Network event in Beaufort, I met some wonderful people, including Gloria Tinubu, an African-American economist who intended to run for Congress. She had run 2 years earlier and did reasonably well with virtually no support from the National Democratic Party. Gloria and I became friends, and I was happy to help her campaign. Gloria running in a very red state is exactly the type of candidate Democrats need to support if we're going to turn red states blue. During that trip to the South in mid-October 2014, we also had a breakfast town meeting with trade unionists and the general public in Atlanta, Georgia. The meeting was organized by South Forward and a local chapter of the Communication Workers of America, the CWA. Here's how Cole Stangler of In These Times described it, and I quote, "It's early on Friday morning, and the union hall is packed with people waiting to see Bernie Sanders. Mostly gray-haired retirees fill the first few rows, while unionists, college students, and activists, including some veterans of the Occupy movement, are scattered toward the back of the modestly sized room. They're here for a town hall meeting that's been billed the Fight for Economic Justice. When the Vermont senator arrives a bit later than advertised, the crowd at Communications Workers of America Local 3204's headquarters in Atlanta greets the 72-year-old independent with a raucous standing ovation. Sanders may be 1,000 miles away from his New England constituency, but here he is the people's senator, as a couple of folks declare during the question and answer portion of the meeting." End of quote. I was pleasantly surprised that 200 people showed up in Atlanta. There was a great deal of energy and excitement in the room. People wanted cell phone photos. I was beginning to get used to the concept of the selfie. The lesson that I learned from that first trip was that even in the most conservative parts of America, the Deep South, there were many people, black and white, who were sick and tired of the economic and political status quo. They understood that the rich were getting richer while most everyone else was getting poorer. They were anxious to come out to meetings to hear an alternative vision of where America should be going. They were prepared to fight back, and the word socialism didn't frighten them. We were off to a good start. If this was conservative America, what would the rest of the country look like? On February 9, 2016, New Hampshire would hold the first primary in the country as part of the Democratic presidential nominating process. It would take place 1 week after the Democratic caucus in Iowa, where the very first votes are cast. We may not have known much about running a national campaign, but we did know that New Hampshire and Iowa were enormously important, and that if I chose to run, we would have to focus a lot of attention on those two states. During this period, we began reaching out to Iowa and New Hampshire. Who did we know in those states? Where could I speak? Who should we contact in the local media? What kind of volunteer support could we put together? Obviously, New Hampshire was going to be an easier task for us. It is Vermont's sister state, and we share a long border. We had some friends there, and my son Levy was a resident. Also importantly, some Vermont television and newspapers get into the state, and a number of people there knew who I was. Over the years, I had given speeches in New Hampshire on several occasions. Iowa was going to be much more difficult. I had been there only once in my life, and we knew virtually no one there. As was to be the case in many other states, in Iowa, we were starting from scratch. In mid-April 2014, I was invited to speak at the Institute of Politics at St. Anselm College in Manchester, New Hampshire. The Institute, led by Neil Levesque, plays an important role in New Hampshire's primary process. Almost all presidential candidates speak there. As I waited to step on stage, it was interesting to see the photos and posters of candidates past and present on the Institute's walls. Some of those candidates made it to the New Hampshire primary and all the way to the White House. Others are a blip on the memory. That's politics. New Hampshire is across the Connecticut River from Vermont, and Manchester is about 3 hours away from my home in Burlington. On April 12th, Jane, some staff members, and I drove there from Burlington. My son Levy met us there. The room where candidates speak at St. Anselm is not particularly large. It seats maybe 200 people. I spoke to a standing room only crowd. I was surprised to learn that it was one of the largest turnouts in recent years. Speaking at the Institute of Politics not only gave me the opportunity to address hundreds of people in New Hampshire, it gave me a national television audience, as C-SPAN covered it as part of their Road to the White House series. WMUR, the largest television station in New Hampshire, also covered the speech. They reported, and I quote, "During the event, Sanders said the middle class is disappearing, poverty is up, and had strong words about health care in the United States. And then they quoted me in saying, there is something profoundly wrong when in this great nation, we are the only major country on earth that does not guarantee health care coverage as a right of citizenship." Sanders said he is considering a bid for president in 2016. He said he hasn't decided if he would run as an independent or a Democrat. He said he doesn't shy away from a platform built on a socialist agenda. Quote, "To create a society in which all people have a fair shot rather than just a nation that is dominated by big money interest is something that I will fight for," end quote, is what he said. Sanders said his decision on a run for the White House will not be affected by former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's presidential candidacy decision. End of quote. An aside, I am more than aware that C-SPAN has a relatively small viewing audience compared with the major networks. But I have always been a big fan of C-SPAN, both as a senator and as a presidential candidate. C-SPAN plays an enormously important role, and positive role, in the political life of our country, because it portrays political reality as it is, without spin, without commentary or prejudice. It covers the proceedings in Congress day after day, including important committee hearings. Nothing dramatic, just what goes on. In terms of campaigns, it covers speeches and rallies and gives candidates the opportunity to communicate with the American people in a way that soundbites and brief interviews do not allow. In late June, I visited New Hampshire again, speaking at a town meeting in Warner in the afternoon and a county Democratic dinner in Milford in the evening. What do you do on a hot day in New Hampshire when you have hours to kill before the next event? You go swimming in a nearby river. That's what we always did on the campaign trail in Vermont. Why not do the same in New Hampshire? That's an advantage of campaigning in a rural area. Always bring your bathing suit. In September, I was invited by Mark McKenzie, the New Hampshire AFL-CIO president, to keynote their Labor Day breakfast. The meeting was attended by many Democratic state officials, including the governor and senator. The midterm elections were 2 months away, and the turnout for the breakfast was large. The response I received was very positive, which was noted by the local media. This was not insignificant. To win in New Hampshire, we would need strong labor support. We were off to a good start there. In late April 2014, Phil and I made another trip to the South. In North Carolina, we attended a meeting of some very brave people. These were workers in the fast food industry employed at McDonald's, Burger King, Wendy's, and other fast food restaurants who were earning $8 or $9 an hour with limited benefits. There were maybe 50 people in the room when I spoke, mostly African American, with some whites and Latinos as well. Together, they were learning from union organizers about how to work together and fight for a living wage, $15 an hour, and the right to form a union in the fast food places where they work. Talk about courage and standing up to the system. Talk about grassroots organizing. Talk about making real change. In many of the speeches that I gave during the campaign, I discussed how real change never comes from the top on down. It always comes from the bottom on up, when ordinary people stand up and fight back. That is exactly what these workers were doing. Some of the workers there were parents who had brought their young kids to the meeting. They knew, I knew, that it was impossible to raise children on $8 or $9 an hour. Their efforts and the efforts of many thousands of others engaged in the Fight for 15 struggle are paying off. All across the country, city and state governments are responding to the pressure and raising the minimum wage to a living wage. That's what we have to do at the federal level. That's what I talked about at every speech I gave. As would often be the case throughout the campaign, meeting courageous people like these workers inspired me and filled me with optimism for the future. During that same trip, we held a town meeting at North Carolina State University in Raleigh. A young student there named Ben Stockdale, active in the Young Democrats, did an excellent job of organizing, and to my surprise, some 225 people showed up. The panel of young people who spoke before I did discussed environmental issues, women's issues, student debt, and the needs of the LGBT community. In our town meetings, the panel discussions we had before I spoke were an important part of what we were trying to accomplish. While speakers may have focused on different topics, it was important to see the commonality of interests and the need for everyone to work together. At North Carolina State University, it was very moving to hear young people who were so articulate and passionate. In August 2014, Phil and I traveled to the South again. We went back to North Carolina, where we attended a meeting with trade union leaders at the AFL-CIO headquarters in Raleigh. This was the conservative South, but we learned that there were serious and progressive people there, black and white, actively organizing for a better future for working people. When a discussion took place about the presidential campaign, I heard support in the room. Some, however, believed that if I ran, it should be done outside the Democratic Party, with the goal of building a new political movement. While this was a minority opinion, it surfaced frequently. A number of people we ran into felt that the Democratic Party was just too conservative and corrupt and could not be reformed. After the meeting with the AFL-CIO leadership, we attended a town meeting in a local church that we had organized and had a standing room only crowd of over 200 people. Once again, our panel consisted of people from different walks of life. We had a young college student, a trade unionist, and a local representative of the Democratic Party. Our goal was to build coalitions and to bring people together, and we were making some progress. Also in August, I received the Patriot Award from the American Legion, the largest veterans organization in the country. In receiving the award, I spoke to an audience of 2,500 American Legion representatives from across the country in Charlotte, North Carolina. This is the most prestigious award the American Legion presents, and as the former chairman of the U.S. Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs, I was honored to receive it. National Commander Daniel M. Dellinger said that the award was being presented for my, quote, unwavering dedication to our nation and its veterans, end quote. The American Legion is, by and large, a conservative organization. Many of their members vote Republican. It showed real courage on their part to give that award to one of the most progressive members of the U.S. Senate. Throughout my political career, and especially as chairman of the Veterans Committee, I have been a strong advocate for veterans and their families. It has always seemed to me that if men and women are prepared to put their lives on the line to defend this country, we have a moral obligation to do everything we can to protect them and their families when they return to civilian life. This means a strong and well-run VA, the best quality health care we can provide, and prompt payment of benefits they have earned. Some may see it as incongruous for a strong progressive to be a fierce advocate for veterans' rights. I don't, and I never have. I opposed the war in Vietnam when I was a young man. I opposed the first Gulf War and the war in Iraq as a member of Congress. I will continue to do everything I can to make sure the United States does not get entangled in wars that we should not be fighting. But I will never blame the men and women who do the fighting for getting us into those wars. If you don't like the wars we get involved in, hold the President and Congress responsible. Don't blame the veterans. During that southern trip, Phil and I traveled to South Carolina. In Columbia, we met with a very impressive organizer with the Service Employees International Union, the SEIU, the union pushing the Fight for 15 campaign. We talked about low-income workers and voter participation. The woman had recently checked out voter registration information in the area. It turned out that of the 500 workers she was attempting to organize, most of whom were black, only a handful were registered to vote. While I was there, I also met with a young black man who worked at McDonald's. He and I chatted for a while. He informed me that, to him and his friends, politics was totally irrelevant to their lives. It was not something they cared about or even talked about. Frankly, this lack of political consciousness is exactly what the ruling class of this country wants. The Koch brothers spend hundreds of millions of dollars to elect candidates who represent the rich and the powerful. They understand the importance of politics. Meanwhile, people who work for low wages, have no health insurance, and live in inadequate housing don't see a connection between the reality of their lives and what government does or does not do. Showing people that connection is a very big part of what a progressive political movement has to do. How can we bring about real social change in this country if people in need are not involved in the political process? We need a political revolution. We need to get people involved. We need to get people voting. While in South Carolina, I spoke at a rather poorly attended healthcare rally on the grounds of the state capitol. Like most other Republican states, South Carolina had rejected the Medicaid expansion provided by the Affordable Care Act. The result was that hundreds of thousands of low-income South Carolinians, black and white, were not receiving the health insurance they were eligible for, despite the fact that it was national legislation and paid for by the federal government. Some of those people will unnecessarily die. Others will become sicker than they should have become. This type of reactionary governmental action in South Carolina and elsewhere could only take place in a political environment where public consciousness is extremely low, where people feel powerless and don't vote. While at the rally, I had the good luck to meet Virginia Sanders, a no-nonsense black woman in her 70s. We hit it off right away. Virginia had been involved in the civil rights movement, had lived in the area forever, and it seemed knew every person in South Carolina. The next morning, Phil and I got a historical tour as we drove off the beaten path around Columbia with this remarkable woman. I knew that if I ran for president, Virginia would be exactly the kind of person I'd want on my staff. 8 months later, she was on board. One of the challenges of a campaign is good scheduling. Don't arrange for the candidate to be in two places at the same time. Make sure the candidate has enough time to go from one event to the other. Schedule events at a time when people are likely to attend. And in South Carolina, don't have a public meeting in Columbia on the opening of the University of South Carolina's football season. Unfortunately, that's exactly what we did. Being unfamiliar with the culture of the area, we had not realized that football games at the university were something like supercharged national holidays. Schools shut down, huge traffic jams occur, the game is the sole topic of conversation. Despite that scheduling mistake, we had a successful town meeting at a senior citizen housing complex in Columbia. Some 200 people showed up, many of them seniors. I stressed the fact that instead of cutting Social Security, as many Republicans wanted to do, we should expand the program. Erin McKee, the president of the South Carolina AFL-CIO, spoke at the meeting, as did a low-wage fast food worker. Erin later became an active supporter of our campaign. It goes without saying that fundraising is an important part of any national campaign. As a U.S. senator and former congressman, I had done my fair share of raising money. In contemplating a campaign for the White House, there was one thing I was absolutely certain of. I was not going to spend large amounts of time raising money from wealthy individuals, as most politicians, Democrats and Republicans do. I much preferred spending my time doing free public meetings and talking to ordinary people. Raising money from the rich is not only debilitating, it's time-consuming. While it is certainly not true for all, many wealthy contributors are arrogant and self-centered and demand a lot of time and access for the money they donate. Instead of just sending you a check, they want to talk and talk and talk about their needs or the issues that concern them. This process drains the energy right out of you. A year later, when I was a full-time candidate, I was truly amazed by the amount of time Hillary Clinton was spending raising money at the homes of wealthy people, talking to 50 or 100 very rich folks. It was really incredible. But it was not just Hillary Clinton. It is what most politicians do and what a corrupt campaign finance system is all about. Today, politics is largely about raising tons of money, hiring consultants and pollsters, and spending a fortune on television advertising. That is why we urgently need real campaign finance reform and why we should move to public funding of elections. But, like every other candidate, we needed money. How could we raise some and not lose our focus on turning out large numbers of people? The solution was simple. While most of our meetings were admission-free, we would do a few low-donor events and see what happened. In June 2014, I had been invited to speak at the University of Chicago. While there, my fundraiser, Ben Eisenberg, a native of the Chicago area, put together an event at a large bar in Evanston, Illinois. The admission price was $25. The logistics were terrible. The audience was gathered in several weirdly shaped rooms, and I could hardly see many of the people I was speaking to. The sound system barely worked, and the crowd was raucous and loud. Nonetheless, the meeting was a success. Hundreds of people showed up, they had a great time, and we raised some money. Conclusion: on occasion, it would be possible to bring out good crowds at the same time as we raise some campaign funds. As one of the Senate leaders in the fight to protect the U.S. Postal Service, I was invited to speak before 6,000 workers at the National Association of Letter Carriers, the largest postal union in the country. The Postal Service has been, for years, under intense political attack by Republicans who ultimately want to privatize all or some of it. The workers were aware of my efforts in support of their needs. The response was very positive. Ed Garvey of Madison, Wisconsin is a dear friend of mine. He has had an extraordinary career as a labor lawyer and received a great deal of national attention as the founder and executive director of the National Football League Players Association. In that capacity, he educated the public that while professional football players do make good salaries, their careers are mostly short and their bodies are often damaged. Ed is a progressive leader in Wisconsin and had run a strong campaign for governor there. Years earlier, he had come to Vermont to help me as we struggled to protect jobs and wages against a union-busting rail company that had taken over a Vermont railroad. Ed and Betty Garvey, John Nichols, Mary Batari, and other Wisconsin progressives had put together a terrific event that I loved very much and attended as often as I could. It was called the Fighting Bob Fest, named after Bob La Follette, the great Wisconsin governor and U.S. senator from the early part of the 20th century. The event took place at the Sauk County Fairgrounds in Baraboo, Wisconsin, was attended by thousands of people from throughout the state, and involved dozens of progressive organizations. On September 13, 2014, I look forward to speaking at the event. While in the Midwest, we were also going to visit Iowa. A problem arose, however, a good problem. If one of my goals in testing the waters for a presidential run was to attract national media attention, that strategy was working. After 25 years in Congress, often as a leading voice on some of the most important issues facing the country, I was invited for the first time to be on Meet the Press. Chuck Todd had recently taken over as host, and he asked me to be on the show, which was recorded at the NBC studio in Washington. The problem was that I was supposed to be in Baraboo at the same time. Now, how do you appear in Washington, D.C. and Baraboo, Wisconsin almost simultaneously? The answer is simple but expensive. You charter a private plane. For $13,000, we were able to make it to Wisconsin right on time. It was the first time we had chartered a plane, but it would not be the last. The event in Wisconsin was a lot of fun. It was a beautiful fall day, and some 4,000 people showed up. My old friend Jim Hightower, the talented and humorous writer from Texas, was there, as well as other national and state leaders. I had a great time renewing acquaintances with my many friends from Wisconsin and the Midwest. After Wisconsin, it was on to Iowa. Iowa, New Hampshire, and beyond. The state of Iowa plays a unique and outsized role in American presidential politics. It is the first state in the country, followed closely by New Hampshire, to vote in the nominating process. It is the state that, through its caucus, provides the first indication of how well a candidate might do overall and how serious his or her campaign is. For many campaigns, Iowa is make or break. Some campaigns, like Barack Obama's, gain momentum from their showings there. Others do poorly and never recover. Back in September 2011, I made my first visit to Iowa to speak at the Tom Harkin Steak Fry, one of the major annual Democratic political events in the country. Tom was one of the most progressive members of the Senate, a good friend of mine, and I very much appreciated the invitation. While the weather for this outdoor event was not cooperative and the crowd not as large as expected, I had a great time and my remarks were well received. I liked the people I met there. They were down-to-earth, unpretentious, and very much like the people of Vermont. I was especially impressed by how many trade unionists and working-class people were in attendance. In the early part of our exploratory campaign, Phil and I made several trips to Iowa. On one of our first trips in May 2014, I spoke to several hundred people at the Clinton County Democratic Party Hall of Fame dinner in Goose Lake. Coming from a rural state, I felt very comfortable in the tiny town that we were in, which had a very small old bank that looked like it might have been robbed by Jesse James. In other early trips to Iowa, we made the acquaintance of a grassroots organization called Citizens for Community Improvement, CCI, led by Hugh Espy, an excellent organizer. This organization brings together people from all walks of life, farmers, trade unionists, educators, environmentalists, senior citizens, to address the major issues facing Iowa and the country. They are organizers, educators, and lobbyists for the public. When we later articulated the concept of the political revolution and the need for citizens to come together in grassroots organizations to take back our government from the 1%, groups like CCI were exactly what I had in mind. In addition to smaller meetings with CCI activists, in mid-September we held a number of town meetings around the state. We met in Dubuque and in Waterloo. We also held a town meeting at the Grace United Methodist Church in Des Moines, sponsored by the CCI Action Fund. The crowd of 450 spilled out into the streets. For an undeclared candidate in Iowa, so long before the caucus, this was an excellent turnout of highly energized people. During that meeting, as I was to do at most meetings, I asked the audience whether or not they thought I should run for president and whether they would be willing to play a role in the campaign. Some 75% voiced support for a campaign. While it wasn't unanimous, the vast majority thought I should run as a Democrat. On October 5, 2014, I returned to Iowa as the keynote speaker at the Johnson County Democratic Party barbecue in Iowa City. Senator Debbie Stabenow of Michigan was there as well. At this gathering of Iowa Democrats, a few weeks before the important midterm elections, something became very clear to me. The energy, even amongst these strong and dedicated Democrats, just wasn't there for the local candidates. Something was missing. Bruce Braley, a congressman from Iowa, was running for the U.S. Senate to replace my friend Tom Harkin. Bruce is a very decent guy, but his remarks, which consisted of tepid Democratic centrist rhetoric, were just not resonating with people in the room. It was obvious that the people there wanted something more. A few weeks later in New Hampshire, I noticed the same phenomenon. On election day, Bruce lost his race to Joni Ernst. At that meeting, for the very first time, I noticed lapel stickers supporting my candidacy. A lot of people were wearing them. They were distributed by a group called Progressive Democrats of America. While a relatively small national group, the PDA had been enthusiastically supporting my candidacy from the very beginning. In May, I did several events with them in Massachusetts. While I was busy running around the country, I also held a few meetings in Washington, D.C. I wanted to get a sense of what the inside the Beltway liberal community was thinking in terms of a Sanders run for the presidency. If truth be told, most of them did not have a lot of enthusiasm for it. There was the overwhelming perception that Hillary Clinton was going to be the nominee. Why stir the pot? Why cause unnecessary conflict? That was also the message I got from my Senate colleagues. Almost zero interest. Strange. It was picking up increased excitement and interest all over the country, but not much in D.C. 10 days after Iowa, we were on our way out west. First stop, Las Vegas. Hot, hot, hot. We got out of the plane to a temperature of 106 degrees. Most people go to Las Vegas to party and to gamble, not us. We were there to meet with the people who serve the tourists their food, wash their dishes, and make their beds. We had a meeting set up with the Culinary Workers Union Local 226, affiliated with the National Unite Here Union. The Culinary Workers Union is one of the great unions in this country, and what they have accomplished is nothing less than revolutionary. At a time when we have lost millions of decent-paying manufacturing jobs, and when more and more of the new jobs being created in our country are low-wage service industry jobs, the Culinary Workers Union has shown the world that people who make beds, serve foods, and clean toilets can earn a living wage, have good health care, and live middle-class lives. They did this by taking on the hotels and organizing the workers there into a strong and effective multiracial union of 60,000 members. The union also plays a major role in Nevada politics. To those people who tell you that politics doesn't matter, just talk to the chambermaids in Las Vegas, who now earn a decent living, have good health insurance, and a pension, and can send their kids to college. They did it. We can do it all across the country. Service industry jobs do not have to be low-wage jobs. And then it was on to California for a very exciting evening. In Richmond, a working-class community in Contra Costa County, the Richmond Progressive Alliance had taken control of the city council under the leadership of Green Party member Gail McLaughlin. Chevron, which had a giant oil refinery in the city, didn't like the idea of a progressive government. They didn't want to pay more in taxes. They didn't want to deal with strong environmental standards. They preferred to have a more compliant, more corporately oriented city council. And they put $3 million in campaign contributions into the local election to make that happen. In other words, they were trying to buy the local government. I was invited by the mayor and the Richmond Progressive Alliance to speak at a meeting in opposition to Chevron and for the re-election of the Progressive City Council. It turned out to be one of the largest and loudest audiences that I had spoken to since I began traveling around the country. As the Bill Moyers and Company website reported, quote, after an hour-long speech, Sanders had the crowd of around 500 on their feet, giving the independent senator from Vermont a standing ovation, end quote. Harriet Rowan of the online news service Richmond Confidential quoted me as saying, at this profound moment in American history, where the billionaire class wants to get it all, we have got to fight back tooth and nail. We cannot allow them to take over Richmond. We cannot allow them to take over America. By the way, the progressives won the election. Chevron, with all its money, was defeated. The next day, we were in Oakland to meet with National Nurses United President Roseanne DeMauro and her staff. And we were pleased to walk into another major controversy. Most everybody loves nurses. We recognize that they are the backbone of our healthcare system. They are there when our babies are born, and they are there when our loved ones die. What I especially loved about the Nurses Union was that they not only fought vigorously for the rights of their members, but even more importantly, they fought for their patients. They want high-quality care in hospitals and wherever they work. They also understand that under the current dysfunctional system, with so many uninsured and underinsured, they are unable to do the quality work they want to do and were trained to do. That is why they are strong supporters of a Medicare for All single-payer program. When I visited with them on October 17, 2014, there was considerable concern about the Ebola crisis and whether American hospitals were effectively prepared to deal with it. National Nurses United also wanted to make sure that their members had the proper equipment and protective gear to treat Ebola patients. After a rally outside the union's building, I helped lead a march to Kaiser Permanente headquarters. They didn't appear happy to see us. The next time I returned to Oakland, the union endorsed my candidacy. I didn't have a strong ally during the course of my campaign. I am always proud to stand with the nurses. In October 2014, I did two sets of meetings in New Hampshire focusing on college campuses. Not only was I testing the waters for myself, but I was trying to get some votes for Senator Gene Shaheen, who was in a tough re-election fight against former Senator Scott Brown of Massachusetts. I learned something very interesting during those visits, something that I did not forget. The earlier visit on October 10th was to the University of New Hampshire in Durham and was organized by a group of progressive students. These young people were serious about politics. They knew what they believed in and were fighting for real change. They were motivated, hardworking, and well-organized. They felt strongly that big money in politics was threatening our democracy and were part of a national movement to bring about real campaign finance reform. I was delighted to accept an invitation from them to speak on campus. When I got to the auditorium, I found an excellent turnout of some 300 people, not only students, but community members as well. It was a great meeting and a thrill to see such bright young people in action. 2 weeks later in New Hampshire, I had a very different experience. Working with local Democrats, we had scheduled meetings at Keene State College, Dartmouth, and Plymouth State. Unlike the meeting at the University of New Hampshire, these were badly attended. The local Democrats had done a poor job in organizing the events, and political interest on campus was very low. In fact, walking around Keene State, I had the distinct impression that not only was Senator Shaheen not going to get many votes on that campus, but that 2 weeks before the election, most students didn't even know that an election was occurring. That visit was extremely depressing. The lesson I learned from those visits was that establishment Democratic politicians often have very few roots in their communities and are unable to generate grassroots enthusiasm. In too many cases, they lived in their own world, separated from ordinary people. On the other hand, what I also saw was that small numbers of dedicated and motivated people were capable of bringing people together, creating excitement and interest, and having a real impact. In many ways, what happened in New Hampshire on those two visits became a metaphor for what was to take place a year later during my campaign for the presidency. Time and time again, we took on the entire Democratic establishment, governors, senators, and mayors, and time again, our small ragtag group of volunteers and staff created the excitement and political interest to defeat them. A presidential campaign is a national campaign. To win, you have to do well all over the country. In late October, we took our show on the road to California, Nevada, and Texas. On the way back east, we stopped in Chicago. This western swing was the most successful trip we had taken so far, as we pondered whether or not to run. More than any other set of meetings, it showed me that our support was growing and that people wanted real change. We were also attracting some great and committed people who were prepared to come on board if I ran. Marianne Williamson is a best-selling author, well-known lecturer, and community activist in California. She is also the founder of Sister Giant, an organization that provides women the support they need to run for political office. She has an enormous following and is active on social media. On March 28, 2015, I spoke before a very large audience at a Sister Giant conference. Marianne, a dynamic speaker, could not have been more supportive. As she introduced me, the chants became louder and louder. Run, Bernie, run. Run, Bernie, run. A large majority in the audience indicated that they were prepared to volunteer in the campaign if I ran. The next day, we had an even more mind-blowing experience. On short notice, the Progressive Democrats of America had organized an event for us in West Hollywood. It was a beautiful Sunday afternoon, and I had my doubts as to how many people would show up. Well, over 500 people packed the hall of the local musicians' union, one of the largest turnouts we had ever had. The excitement was palpable. Once again, we heard, "Run, Bernie, run. Run, Bernie, run." And all over the hall, people were signing up to volunteer. Then it was on to a plane to Austin, Texas, and what an unbelievable meeting we had there. As our car was getting closer to our destination in IBEW Union Hall, I was becoming more and more annoyed at the traffic. We were moving at a crawl, and I was worried that we would be late. Not to worry. Our meeting was the cause of the traffic jam, and everybody was going to be late. There was a fellow on the road trying to direct traffic, and cars were parked all over the place. People were packed into the room, some sitting on windowsills. And what was so beautiful and memorable about that meeting, and something that we would see so often in the future, was the diversity of the people who attended. There were workers, students, senior citizens, Latinos, blacks, and whites. These were people coming together with passion to transform America. This meeting, almost more than any we had held so far, told me that something unusual was going on. I was not well known in Texas, and yet the excitement for a Sanders campaign was sky high. I had known Rahm Emanuel when we served together in Congress, and I had dealt with him when he was chief of staff for President Obama. Rahm was part of the corporate wing of the Democratic Party, a prolific fundraiser, closely aligned with the Clintons. He and I were not best friends. Rahm left Washington and moved on to become mayor of Chicago. In 2015, he ran for re-election. To everybody's surprise, despite spending a huge amount of money, he was unable to get the 50% that he needed to win the Democratic Party nomination for mayor on the first round. His opponent was Jesus Chuy Garcia, a strong progressive and a county commissioner. In addition to the mayor's race, there were a number of progressives running for the Board of Aldermen against the Democratic machine. 50 years before, when I was a student at the University of Chicago, I got slightly involved in an aldermanic election. I volunteered for a candidate who was in opposition to what was then known as the Daley machine. Now I was back as a U.S. senator, once again supporting a progressive candidate running against the Chicago Democratic machine. Not much had changed politically in Chicago over 50 years. I liked Chuy because he was putting together the kind of coalition that I believed in. Black, white, and Latino working people standing together against the big money interests that controlled the city. In Chicago, while the downtown business interests thrived, the neighborhoods were hurting and schools were being closed. In that primary election, I was also supporting Susan Sanlasky Garza, who was running for the Board of Aldermen from a working-class district. The rally in support of Chuy and Susan took place in a steelworkers' union hall. The place was mobbed, the enthusiasm high. This was the first time that I gotten to meet Chuy, and I liked him. After his defeat by Emanuel, Chuy Garcia became a great surrogate for me during the campaign. He traveled the country, often speaking to Latino audiences. Chuy and his wife and Jane and I had breakfast together the morning of the Illinois primary. Susan, who ran against a longtime incumbent, won her election by a few votes and is now a member of the Board of Aldermen. I was glad I could help. Election Day 2014. Election Day 2014 was a disaster for Democrats all across the country. With voter turnout atrociously low, the Democrats lost control of the U.S. Senate for the first time since 2006 and lost seats in the House as well. Like other Democrats, I had to give up my chairmanship to a Republican. Needless to say, the Democrats in the Senate were sullen. Harry Reid, our majority leader and a friend of mine, was out. Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, was in. In the 2014 election, the Republicans won the largest majority in Congress since 1928 and the largest majority of state legislatures since 1928. How could it happen that an obstructionist Republican Party, which was in favor of cutting Social Security, Medicare and Medicaid, giving huge tax breaks to billionaires, and unwilling to recognize the reality of climate change, could win a landslide victory? To my mind, understanding Election Day 2014 was not to see it as a victory for the Republican Party. It was a loss for the Democratic Party. The Democrats blew it big time. Republicans win elections when voter turnout is low and their big money friends spend a fortune on ugly TV ads. Democrats win elections when ordinary people are excited, involved in the political process, and come out to vote. In 2014, 63% of the American people didn't vote, and the turnout was even worse for low-income and young people. As I saw in Iowa and New Hampshire, there was very little energy or enthusiasm for the Democratic candidates. In my own state of Vermont, where a Democratic governor won re-election in a close race, we had the lowest voter turnout since World War II. Yes, the economy was better than it had been when President Bush left office. Yes, there had been a major troop withdrawal from Iraq. Yes, President Obama was doing a number of things that were right. But despite that, something was deeply wrong in the country, and people felt it. Millions of workers were falling further and further behind. The gap between the rich and everybody else was growing wider. The political system was increasingly corrupt, and the economic and political establishment was far removed from the lives of ordinary Americans. The election of 2014 was a wake-up call for the Democratic Party. I wondered if they heard it. Reaching a decision. As I suspected would happen, the fact that I was, quote, thinking of running for president generated a significant increase in the national media coverage that I received. I was no longer just a U.S. senator. I was now a possible future president. I became a regular on cable TV news, on CNN, MSNBC, and occasionally Fox. I was also appearing on the important Sunday news shows and doing interviews with newspapers all across the country. My communications director, Michael Briggs, did a great job in maximizing media opportunities. When we were in New York City, for example, we started early on the morning shows and went full blast throughout the day. On November 14th, 2014, as an example, I did an early morning interview with Chris Cuomo on CNN, did an editorial board meeting with Bloomberg News, did an interview with New York Times columnist Gail Collins, taped an interview on WNET-TV, met with my old friend Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation magazine, and concluded with an appearance on The Colbert Report. In December 2014, Jane and I attended, as we usually did, the White House Christmas Ball. This is an annual opportunity for members of Congress, the administration, and friends to get together in a bipartisan, informal way. Many hundreds of people attend. One of the very weird things about this event is that the president does not address the people there, and he does not socialize. What he does all night long is take photos. The guests line up on the first floor, get ushered into a room with the president and Michelle, engage in small talk, and get their pictures snapped. While Jane and I were there, I asked the president for a meeting. A week or so later, I met with the president in the Oval Office. I had known Barack Obama for 8 years, and we had served in the Senate together. While I had strong disagreements with him on some issues, we were friends, and I respected him very much. On a number of important matters, we had worked closely together. Now, as I was seriously thinking about running for president, I wanted to get his views on some of the issues that I was discussing around the country. I also wanted his take on the recent elections and where he thought Democratic Party politics was going. As usual, I was impressed by his candor and his intelligence. During this period, we began to focus more on Iowa and New Hampshire, the first two states that would be voting. While the Democratic Party's nominating process is, of course, a national process, it is also 50 separate state elections. And despite their relatively small sizes, Iowa and New Hampshire are two of the most important states. If we did well in those two states, we would be off and running. If we did not, we would not be taken seriously as we advanced to other states. In mid-December, we returned to Iowa for a few days. In Des Moines, I did interviews at the Des Moines Register. The Des Moines Register is the largest and most influential newspaper in Iowa, and it takes its responsibilities seriously. It understands the importance of the Iowa caucus, and it tries to give all of the candidates, Democratic and Republican, a fair shake. It also conducts polling for the Iowa caucus, which is generally regarded to be of very high quality and receives a lot of national attention. During that trip, I also appeared on Iowa Press, Iowa's equivalent of Meet the Press, a public television show with a veteran moderator, Dean Borg. Later in the day, we headed to Ames, where we held a town meeting. Before that meeting, we did something that I found very helpful, something we had not done before. We invited the various elements of the state's progressive community to join us for brief separate meetings so that we could better understand the issues they were dealing with. Within the course of a few hours, we met with some of the leaders of the Latino community, the peace community,